Thanks for the invitation and giving me this opportunity. Yeah, it's really a great pleasure to be able to share what myself and my collaborators are thinking about recently on the story of entanglement linear response. And it's a rather general scheme. And one particular application is that you can use it to extract, say, quantum Hall conductance from a single bulk wave function. And besides that, I'll also talk about some other things that's in the beyond part, because as you can probably tell, Hall conductance is intimately related to anomalies. So I also talk about the relation to that, and that's in the beyond part, and also some other things. And also, let me mention my collaborators. This is done with my Rahul, who is an Ashwin student, and my advisor Ashwin, and Peng Fei and Ying Fei, who were postdocs working with Alexei Kitaev. Okay, and my talk will be based on these three references that you can find on archive. Because my talk will be mainly about this specific task, so let me begin with a broader introduction. So we know that gapped systems can exhibit a variety of topological phenomena at zero temperature. And some these are two well-understood examples. One is this invertible or so-called short-range entangled phase. For example, the Kitaev chain in 1D, in 2D we have integer quantum Hall, in 2D and 3D we have a topological insulator. And they all come with some robust gapless edge mode. And another category is called this topological order. For example, the fractional quantum Hall state and some gapped spin liquid. And their characterizing features are the anions, particle-like excitations with anionic statistics in the bulk. And it is widely accepted that this phenomenon really arises from the entanglement of the ground state, because once I give you a topological phase and a trivial phase, there's no way to distinguish them from local measurement. So that's why this phenomenon really comes from the entanglement in the ground state wave function. But the question is, how do we quantify this connection? And the first answer was found for the 2D topological order by this gentleman. And the answer they gave, what they did is that they found that the total anion quantum dimension can be dictated by looking at the entanglement entropy of a disk region, and it has a topological part. The topological part is related to how many anions you have in your system. But what about other topological invariants? For example, quantum Hall conductance, chirocentric charge, and many, many other things. And people don't have a very good answer for those things yet. On the other hand, one can certainly extend this program to gapless system, right? You doesn't have to restrict yourself to just gapped state. You can ask similar questions in gapless systems. For example, in 1D CFT, we can compute the entanglement of an interval find a logarithmic dependence on the system size, and the coefficient in front of the logarithm gives us the central charge, and is I think it's a very convenient way to extract the central charge in quantum system. And of course, we can also ask the question in Fermi liquid and the presence at least it's a belief that the presence of a logarithmic violation to the area law term is intimately related to the presence of a Fermi surface. So we can put this program, so we are really probing the relation between quantum order, for example, it can be topological phenomena or central charge or Fermi surface, this quantum order, and what's the relation between this and the entanglement. Or we can ask this, it's equivalent to ask this question, like what happened when entanglement met locality? Okay. And so why it's an interesting question? And the motivation really comes from various directions. First, it gives us some non-perturbative information or the constraints on quantum many-body systems. Like there are some beautiful work by, I think it's Taron, on how to constrain, for example, the transition between MBL and thermal phase using this entanglement or some constraints on spin liquid. And also it facilitates some entanglement-based numerical studies like tensor network. For example, we can ask the compatibility between some tensor network architecture and the entanglement structure of the many-body wave function. Once you have that kind of information, it immediately suggests what would be the best tensor network architecture we should use for certain purposes. The next is it gives us a Hamiltonian-free characterization of quantum order that is completely based on this information perspective. And this is very, very important when we want to talk about the notion of topological phases in open systems, where one can actually show that actually conventional probe fails in such a situation. Let's say you have a toric code and you turn on some local error, and conventional probe fails in situation, and you have to use information perspective to define and probe your topological phases. And last thing is that also it's very important for study entanglement in QFT. For example, we know that QFT suffered from UV divergence, and such a program can help us to distill universal data from those divergence and ambiguities. And here I want to propose a very general idea. We call it entanglement response, to study the above question systematically, at least along certain directions systematically. It is about understanding intrinsic dynamics generated by the state itself, which is known as the modular flow in mathematics or high energy physics. And just as one application, we want to show how it can be applied to extract the quantum Hall conductance, or more generally, understanding this triangle between topological response, anomaly, and the entanglement response. Okay. And so here it will be the outline of the bulk of this talk. I will start with a review on topological entanglement entropy and how to reformulate that study in terms of this entanglement Hamiltonian. And after we do that formulation, and how we want to generalize will become clear. I hope it become clear to everyone. And that comes to the second part. And then I will talk about our proposal for the Hall conductance, and give some justifications, and end with a summary and outlook. And I want to emphasize that this work is really largely motivated by a previous study on extracting chirocentral charge using entanglement Hamiltonian. But the perspective I'm going to present here will be completely different from what that is used in these works. And please interrupt me anytime if you have any questions. Any question now? Okay, yeah, so let me begin with a review on topological entanglement entropy. The first answer people found between entanglement and topological phenomena. So let's say we consider a two-dimensional system, and that is denoted by this square, and we take a disk A, and the outside is denoted by D. So the Hilbert space has a factorized structure HA, tensor product HD, and the ground state wave function psi it's called psi. And we can construct the reduced density matrix by tracing out degrees of freedom outside A, and we denote that by rho A. And we can compute entanglement entropy for A, and to the leading order, it's proportional to the parameter of region A, and it comes with a subleading piece gamma that is dictated by, argued to be related to the total quantum dimension. Of course, a much better definition is to consider some linear superposition like this. So we further divide the disk A into three parts, A, B, and C, and we consider this linear superposition between A, SB, SC, and so on, this entanglement entropy of different subregions. And if you assume this form, this leading piece will cancel out, and you are left with only the subleading term gamma. And this is a much better definition of what we mean by topological entanglement entropy, because it explicitly involves adding and subtracting entanglement entropy of different regions. It's not just quite bipartite entanglement. Okay. And to understand the essence for gamma being topological, and also more importantly, for the purpose of doing generalization, let's take a detour to introduce entanglement Hamiltonian, or it's called a half-sided modular Hamiltonian in mathematics or high energy literatures. The definition is simple. So we have this reduced density matrix rho A obtained by partial trace. And now we take a log of that density matrix and call that our entanglement Hamiltonian Ka. And notice that because rho A, the spectrum of rho A is bounded between 0 and 1, so this entanglement Hamiltonian, the spectrum of the entanglement Hamiltonian is bounded from below. And that's why it's like a Hamiltonian, because its spectrum is bounded from below. And the reduced density matrix becomes a thermostate. It's a rewriting, rho A equals to e to the minus Ka. And the von Neumann entropy now becomes can be rewritten as thermal energy. So it's like this. Originally, S is trace of rho A log rho A, but log rho A becomes K. And so it's written as trace of K times e to the minus Ka. So we can regard this as a fictitious thermostate with respect to this Hamiltonian, entanglement Hamiltonian, and the at temperature 1, and the von Neumann entropy is measuring the total energy with respect to this fictitious thermal equilibrium, and it has this form. Okay, and there are two things I want to emphasize about this, a few things I want to emphasize about properties of entanglement Hamiltonian. So first, it's quite different from physical Hamiltonian. For example, from Stan-Mack, we know that energy should be proportional to volume, but here energy is proportional to the area. So it's quite unusual. And that implies the entanglement Hamiltonian, for example, Ka, is non-uniform in space. Okay? Another thing that is more important for for this talk here is that it satisfies this conversion property. And that is due to we are considering a pure state. For example, we take a state psi, Ka acting on the state psi is equal to Kd, so the entanglement Hamiltonian on the complement region acting on the state psi. And this follows from Schmidt decomposition, which you always have for a pure state. And I want to emphasize that, I want to say that this property is like a symmetry, right, that has actually no analog with the physical Hamiltonian. Because although you consider an eigenstate of physical Hamiltonian, but you want to divide it into two parts, let's say HA and HD, and there is no such decomposition because you always have terms that X cross A and D. So this property has no analog with the physical Hamiltonian. And in some sense, it's like a symmetry because you consider a state that preserves some symmetry. Symmetry transformation in one region is equal to the inverse symmetry transformation in the complement region. Let's say it's onside symmetry.
Is there a physical meaning for Ka acting on the vector space psi? Thank you.
Oh yeah, I think I'm going to talk about that. Ka acting on it doesn't have direct physical interpretation, but you can ask the unitary evolution generated by Ka acting on the state psi, and that is meaningful. Yeah, this is this slide.
I also have a question.
Yeah.
So I'm wondering if, say, if rho A is not full rank, meaning that it
is,
has some...
Sorry, I can't hear you. If rho A is...
It's not full rank.
Oh, full...
Yeah, then can we define it?
Yeah, good question. So if rho A is not full rank, is you first write down the Schmidt decomposition and you didn't take log on those zeros. You don't take log on those zeros. So that's how we define Ka. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, thanks. So on the other hand, the entanglement Hamiltonian also has certain similarities with the physical Hamiltonian. Or more precisely, the edge of physical Hamiltonian. For example, if you look at the spectrum of entanglement Hamiltonian, it's similar to the spectrum. The low energy part is similar to the spectrum of physical Hamiltonian. So this is I plotted for P plus IP superconductor, and you have you can tune your chemical potential to drive a transition from trivial to topological and then to trivial phase. And in the topological phase, you'll find that the entanglement spectrum is gapless near zero, just like the physical spectrum, due to the edge state. And if you look at the associated to the eigenwave function, to those eigenvalues, and you can find that the wave function are mostly supported only on the edge of the subsystem. And maybe a more clear way to see the similarity is to look at the dynamics. So also called modular flow. So we take the state psi and we evolve the system using this entanglement Hamiltonian Ka. And so we apply e to the minus s Ka to the state psi and obtain this evolved state. So let's say we put a particle at the boundary of subregion A and evolve it. In one topological in topological phase with one chirality, it goes in this direction. Then in the other topological phase with the opposite chirality, the state will move in the opposite direction. So it's evolution also like mimics the edge state evolution. And of course, if you put a particle in the bulk of the subsystem, it don't it just gets smeared out, but doesn't move much. Again, these are just some important intuition for our later discussion. So topological entanglement entropy now can be regarded as the study of thermal energy at this fictitious equilibrium phrased in terms of entanglement Hamiltonian. And this quantity is topological, meaning that it's invariant under the change of shapes without changing the topology. The other thing is that it's universal, meaning that it's invariant under local deformation of the state. Later on, I'll show that our formula also has these two properties. So this is my definition of being topological and universal. So for example, you take, remember our formula for this gamma, you can deform the shape of B by some small amount and that doesn't change the answer. So that's invariant and the change of shapes. And the key ingredients for showing these two properties are the following. The first is this conversion property for the entanglement Hamiltonian. The second is the clustering property. So when you have two local operators, when they are far separated, the two-point function factorizes. And the third thing is this. It's rather non-trivial, actually. So you consider in this three region, X, Y, and Z. Notice that X and Z are not adjacent to each other. And you consider the entanglement Hamiltonian for these corresponding regions. So for example, KXY plus KYZ and KXYZ plus KY, okay? As an operator, these two operators are not close to each other by in generic systems. Of course, in special systems like fixed point wave function like toric code or ground states of commuting projectors, one can argue with some assumptions that these two k's are exactly equal, but generically they are not. But the thing is that if you consider their expectation value, their expectation values are equal to each other, and you only need this to show these two properties. Okay, and these are the three ingredients you need to justify topological entanglement entropy is really a good quantity.
Question?
Yeah.
Should I expect the third relation to hold in general?
No. Well, in general, yeah, of course, one can always cook up counterexamples and actually learn those examples from your paper. It depending on whether you call that general or not.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah.
Sorry, just to make sure. We will talk about some mundane or intuitive way to understand the third relation later on, or is there any?
Oh, sorry. Yeah, the relation can be understood that like this. So this is so the expectation value of a K satisfied. Is the entanglement, right? An entanglement entropy, and it's proportional to the length of the boundary of that subregion.
Uh-huh. I see.
So if you compare that part on the two sides, they just cancel each other.
I see. So the violation will be the spurious entanglement entropy.
Yes. But topological entanglement entropy doesn't violate this. But maybe there are some, I don't know. Actually, I do expect this to hold generally. I don't know whether one can cook up examples to. I don't know.
Okay, thanks.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
Sorry, do you expect that to be true for volume law entangled states too?
Yeah, if you have a volume law and the volume law part also cancel each other. Let's just count because X always appear once, Y appear twice, and Z appear once on both sides. So if you have a volume law entangled, just by counting, they should cancel each other. And this is satisfied. But if you have a Fermi surface with a logarithmic violation to the area law part, then this doesn't hold.
But if entanglement Hamiltonian is very non-local, that is not localized near the boundary.
Mm-hmm.
For example, KXYZ may have a term that couples X and Z.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that could happen. Yeah. Yeah. And that doesn't invalidate. Yeah, that is allowed, and that doesn't invalidate this equality immediately, right? Because we are not comparing these operators, we're just comparing their expectation value with respect to the state psi.
So what is the precise condition for this to hold?
Yeah, if you want to, what's the condition? I believe that for gapped state, it should hold.
You mean ground state of the gap state?
Yeah, ground state of a gapped Hamiltonian. But of course, as you said, if you consider a state that satisfies volume law entanglement entropy, this is auto satisfied, and so that's not a. The only case, so the gap state is not the only situation where this is satisfied.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thank you.
Yeah.
What is the precise notion of this approximation since the Fermi surface example is brought up? It's like up to volume law, up to area law, or something like
that? Yeah, for gap state, let me just, because I'm just considering gap state, so let me talk about gap state only. For gap state, this approximate sign means, and there will be a correction term that is exponentially small with respect to the subsystem system size of X, Y, and Z. Also, when the system possesses global symmetries, one can also, for example, measure symmetry defects in addition to just for Neumann entropy. And we have all operators that we have access to, which has the symmetry transformation source. So we can apply symmetry transformation to the region A and measure this quantity. And that also has an area law. And the subleading piece is also topological. And again, it's just a study of properties as this fictitious thermal equilibrium. And now I hope the generalization becomes quite clear, because we don't have to restrict ourselves at this equilibrium. We can go away from it and do linear response. Okay, so now we have to answer two questions. What is the resource and what response we have to measure? And the resource we want to use is the entanglement Hamiltonian, okay, because that's the because it generates the intrinsic dynamics and dynamics associated to the state itself. And the response we want to measure are like von Neumann entropy. And we have a symmetry, you can measure the symmetry defect operators, so on and so forth.
Rehan, let me just make sure. For the defect operator, the area law, that's guaranteed by this the fact that the state is symmetric, right? Or something.
Yeah, symmetric.
I see. What was the reason why the constant?
Oh, sorry. And not just that, because you have a, if you have a gapless state, I don't know whether this is true or not.
Oh, okay.
You probably need
a
gap.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So if, yeah, okay, you need the exponential decay. Remind me, what was the reason why the constant term is universal?
Oh, you can run similar argument like what people Kitaev and Prescott did here.
Oh, I see. Is that basically the quantum dimension associated with
the defect operator? Yeah.
Okay,
yeah.
I see. Okay.
But in some cases, even though the system is trivial, you can have a non-zero gamma.
Trivial at the level of a topological order or what?
Yeah, at the level of topological order. For example, you just consider translator has no topological order, but you can consider this following defect operator e to the I pi q.
Mm-hmm.
And it will have a correction.
Because it's like a Boolean anyhow. So.
Yeah, well, anyway, it depends on G, and it's not just
Oh, okay.
Yeah, there's some subtlety. If you ignore those, it's topological. Yeah.
Okay. Right, thanks.
Mm-hmm.
Sorry, I have a probably doesn't make sense question. Is there a like G theorem related to this? Probably doesn't make sense.
G theorem. Oh, I think in some sense, yeah. Sorry, I'm not familiar with this, so let me not answer that. But I guess you, yeah, sorry, yeah, let me know. So yeah, so this will be our source of perturbation, and this will be the quantity we want to measure. And we'll just call this scheme the entanglement response. So put it more mathematically, we take a state psi and evolve it by entanglement Hamiltonian kx, and we measure some operator on region y. So we compute this thing and monitor how that evolves with this modular time s. And notice that k has no dimension, so s is also dimensionless, in contrary to the ordinary time. So to start, let me just consider the response at the linear order in the modular time s. This is what I mean by entanglement linear response. Okay, you take a derivative of this thing and evaluate it at s equals to zero and ask what you will get. And my claim is that this entanglement linear response will give you some physical topological response. And you put the O, replace O by some U1 symmetry defect, it gives you Hall conductance. It's related to Hall conductance. And if you replace this O by some geometric defect, it should give you chiaroscentral charge. And of course, you can do other symmetry defects. And generally, I believe it gives you conformal spin associated to that defect operator. So let me just give you one example, because this scheme is generic. It doesn't have to be restricted to a gapped state. And you can try to apply it to other situations. And here is one example that will be useful for our later discussion. So I applied it to 1D CFT. So we consider a pure 1D CFT, okay? And we want to show how this scheme can give us U1 chiral anomaly. So the CFT has a U1 symmetry, or it comes with this current operator J and J tilde, and has this, they have this OPE. And now let's just repeat the entanglement linear response exercise, okay? We take the system, we put the system on the cylinder, on the ring, okay, or on a circle, and we want to evolve the system by KAB, and want to measure now the U1 symmetry defect on the region BC. So we want to measure E to the I mu QBC. Okay. And it follows from the conformal invariance that KAB is a local integral of your stress energy tensor T00 with some envelope function. But its property follows from unconformal invariance. And we can replace this e to the I mu QBC by two defect operators that are sitting at the boundary of this region BC. Right? This is by, and this operator mu of this V, and they are not mutually local with a charged operator, and they have the following scaling conformal dimension. For example, this V mu has a holomorphic conformal dimension proportional to KL, and anti-holomorphic conformal dimension proportional to KR, and they are both proportional to mu squared. That's somehow very important, actually. Okay, and now you can just compute this thing using conformal field theory technique and write down, for example, this guy. You compute the modulus of how this operator evolves and take a log, and then take a derivative with respect to the modular time and evaluate it as equal to zero. And generally, the answer will be very, very complicated. But in this limit, the result gets simplified. So you can see the limit where this point approaches this point. So in this case, ABC, they form the entire circle. And in this limit, your answer just becomes this. Okay, and now, now I want to make the following assumption. So you can see that the additional assumption I want to make is that this state can be realized on the lattice, or rather it has a Schmidt decomposition, so that I can use this conversion property that modular flow on AB can be converted to the modular flow on the complement region, or which is just region C in this special limit. And in that case, what we are doing is really doing this modular flow in C and looking at the response in region BC. But we know that the system has a U1 symmetry, so the modular Hamiltonian on C should commute with the charge BC, and this thing shouldn't have any evolution at all, and we should get zero. So with that additional assumption, we conclude that we must have KL equal to KR. And does that make sense? Okay. Now I want to give the proposal for the Hall conductance. So let me just describe the setup. So again, we use this figure. We divide the plane into four parts, A, B, C, and D. And it's important that D is not empty. Okay. And we want to apply modular flow on AB and measure the charge response in BC. It's pretty much it's pretty much the same as what we did in the 1D CFT calculation, but now we just promoted into this two-dimensional geometry. And now the quantity we want to measure is QBC squared. Okay, QBC is the total charge in region BC. And our proposal is that the linear response of this quantity just yields the Hall conductance. Okay. And so we have this formula. The sigma XY is the Hall conductance, and it's related to, it's given by this.
Is there a simple explanation for why you want the square, Q, you want Q squared and not just Q?
Yeah, the simple explanation is Hall conductance has a unit E squared over H, so you at least need Q squared.
Okay, that makes sense, thanks.
Yeah. A technical reason is that if you just put QBC not square, you get identically zero. And if you want to measure, for example, not charge response, but entanglement entropy of region BC and how was the response of that, you get the previous formula for the Kairos for charge. Okay, And I want to mention there are some previous efforts on extracting quantum Hall conductance. Like for free fermion system, we have a TKN formula in momentum space.
Actually, just let me make sure I get it right. So for this formula, do you care at all whether your region D has a boundary or not?
No, but it has to be not empty.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. Yeah, thanks.
Yeah,
go ahead.
Yeah, if D is empty, then A, B, C are in a pure state. Now you can convert A, B into C, and KC just commute with QPC squared. So you get zero. So that's why D has to be non-empty.
So I presume by that you mean D has to be a lot much larger than the correlation, then?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. I also have a question. Can I ask?
Go ahead, Terence.
What happens if A union B union C is non-contractible? Does it still work?
No, it doesn't.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Yeah, I will show some results for that later.
Another question. Is it clear that these two expressions for the Hall conductance and for the Kettle simple charge are odd on the reflection?
For this guy, it's clear, but for this guy, it's not. I will show you. Yeah.
On the reflection?
Yeah, for this guy, it's quite clear because reflection interchanges A and B. And so you just put this thing is invariant, but this guy becomes KAC. And now you can do another rotation to show it get a minus sign. So this thing is clear, but it's not clear. A priori is not clear for this formula.
But when I do reflection, I also need to do reflection to the state psi.
But that's equivalent, right? You can either do a reflection on your state psi, will keep this indices invariant, or you can do a reflection to this index. You can flip the indices, but keep the state invariant, right? I'm imagining you put a reflection operator R here, it either act on the state or act on the operators.
No, here the K is the entanglement Hamiltonian, which depends on the state.
Oh, okay, I see. Mm-hmm.
If it's an operator that doesn't depend on the state, then I can do that.
Yeah, but then I think that's equivalent to so let's say we do a reflection, so we put psi prime, and here is k prime, and these indices are just a b and b c. I think that's equivalent to you put a psi here but change the indices.
I think it's equivalent to I put psi tilde there, I still change the indices.
Okay, but let's discuss offline maybe. Right. So yeah, there are all these previous efforts, like this TKN is in momentum space and this Fredholm index formula is in real space. And for interacting system, there's some non-trivial generalization of this Fredholm index formula, and there are some other related but different topological invariants called many-body chain number. Our formula is superficially different from all of them, but they should be secretly related. And finding this relation will be a kind of non-trivial and interesting task. For example, in free fermion system, actually, we can show that our formula is indeed related to the real space chain number formula, but a generalized one. I'll talk about later. So here, I want to give some justification on why it's true, why the formula is true. And the basic logic is this. First, I want to show that our formula satisfies the same general properties as the quantum Hall conductance, like additivity, and CRT transformation laws and is topological and universal. And step two is that I want to show you that it's actually non-zero because a quantity that is zero also trivially satisfies all of these properties. So I want to make sure it's zero. So given these two justification, this quantity is likely to work. Okay. So let me first talk about the general properties. The first thing is additivity. For example, we take two states, psi one and psi two, and compute this quantity for their tensor product. And the results should be equal to sigma of psi one plus sigma of psi two. This property looks simple, or yeah, it looks like a silly requirement, but it's very important to rule out the possibility of this thing, the many-body Chern number. And because many-body Chern number, it coincides with the Euro Chern number in free-Feynman system, for example, but it actually is not additive. So this property rules out that possibility. And the second thing is that CRT transformation. So this guy is even under charge conjugation, odd under reflection and time reversal. Okay. And the third thing is topological and universal. For example, you deform the shape, you deform the subregion and perturb the state by a little bit. It doesn't change the answer. And again, the main ingredients to show this are these following three. The first two are the same as what we have used in the study of topological entanglement entropy. For the third thing, we actually need a slightly stronger condition, which is before we only require the expectation value of these two operators are close to each other. But in this case, we need something more. We need not just the expectation value, but we need some operator insertion. Their expectation value are still the same, but that operator cannot be a generic operator. It's a bit involved to say this part very precisely. Let me skip that. But the point is that we need something more beyond the previous requirement.
Just to make sure, previously yeah. About reflection, do you need to assume that say A and C have to be two reflection related regions? Or do you have
this is what I mean by reflection. So I just means, so this is a definition of sigma psi ABC, and I interchange A and B at gamma minus psi. So the shape of ABC doesn't have to be, or the size of ABC doesn't have to be the same. So it's actually stronger than reflection. Okay.
Do you assume that psi itself is invariant under the reflection?
Yeah, I think that's the previous debate I had with Liu Jun. I think you can either change this. What?
I think I was wrong. I was wrong.
You can change the indices without changing the state, or change the state without changing the indices. And maybe I can say that to show the CRT transformation, you only need the first property, but in order to show it's topological and universal, you need the rest too.
So. Without explaining what exactly the third condition is, do you know if it's true for a certain class of states or
yeah, I did some numerical check, and yeah, it's true, for example, for chain insulator.
What about non-free Fermion stuff?
Yeah, that's hard to check. I don't know yet. Yeah.
I guess I can ask for Laughlin wave function, is it at least true?
Yeah, that's a good question. But even for that, it's hard to check. Uh-huh. The difficulty is that we want to, for example, compute entanglement Hamiltonian for this shape of, the geometry complicates stuff. If you just want to compute entanglement Hamiltonian for a disk, that's relatively easy. But if you want to say something about this particular geometry, that becomes hard. Yeah. Yeah, for example, for Chern insulator, it's not true that K satisfy this, but still true that the expectation value is possibly with some insertion. Yeah.
So when you say true, you mean the error is exponentially small?
Yeah.
I see. So can I say that then, strictly speaking, you don't know if this really works for things like Laufen state?
Yeah, I can't say very like 100% sure or something.
I see. But can you at least put Laufen state into this expression and see if it gives you the 1/3 or something?
Oh yeah, even that is a hard task that I'm something I'm trying now.
I see.
Yeah.
Okay. Thanks.
Right. But given this assumption, you can show this property, and we just accept those proper assumptions, and so that our formula at least have these properties. And now, because the sigma is universal, we can deform the state because it's invariant under deformation of the state. So we can deform the state to a very nice one without changing its value, and do the computation with those nice states and show that it's non-zero, for example. And moreover, it gives us the desired answer we want. And in particular, we want to consider a state where the entanglement Hamiltonian can be regarded as a CFT Hamiltonian. And this here, this epsilon is a proportionality constant that is much smaller than one and non-universal. And we consider the expectation value of a U1 defect operator, this thing, and look at how the entanglement linear response of this quantity. And we can go back to this QBC square by doing a Taylor expansion in mu. And what we want to show is this entanglement linear response of this quantity is equal to sigma xy times mu square, where the sigma xy is given by KL minus KR. Okay, and the idea is this: it's a Cardy formula type of argument. So first, the expectation value, given this assumption, of course, the expectation value of a U1 defect operator is given by the charged Cardy formula. Okay, and this guy is satisfying area law with some subleading correction. And this area law has this structure. The leading piece has this structure. It's proportional to LD, the length of the boundary of region D, divided by this non-universal part epsilon. And it has a coefficient KL plus KR times mu square. Okay. So on the boundary, you have some left moving and the right moving charged mode, and they give their contribution to this quantity has the same sign, this KL plus KR. And so we can just separate the error law coefficient into two pieces. So alpha chiral and alpha anti-chiral, proportional to KL and KR respectively, and interpret them as the line tension of this chiral and anti-chiral charged mode, denoted by the red and blue dots in this figure. And their difference is encoded in the motion of modular flow. So if we evolve the state by KD, the red guy moves to the left, and left blue guy move to the right. Okay. And now let's apply the power picture to understand what happens if we want to compute the linear response of this quantity. And notice that there are the only non-trivial contribution, non-zero contribution, comes from the two triple contact point. So let me just focus on one triple contact point and only the chiral movers. So for example, under the modular flow of AB, now we want to look at the modular entanglement linear response of the e to the I mu QBC under the modular flow on AB. And so this guy, for example, it moves in this direction, but it has nothing to do with the BC. So it doesn't make any contribution. And same here. This guy is originally correlating B and D, And after this modular flow, it just changes position. So to the leading order, it doesn't affect the correlation. It doesn't make any non-zero contribution. So the non-trivial thing happens here. For example, this guy, it originally correlates A and D, but after modular flow, it enters B. So it increases the correlation between B and D and makes a change to this quantity. And the other triple contact point is this guy. So this thing, originally it correlates B and C, but this quantity is measuring the QBC, the correlation between QBC and the complements. So originally this pair does not make any contribution, but after you do modular flow, it enters A and it starts to correlate A and C, and will also increase this quantity. And the anti-chiral mode will have the opposite contribution. So we have a minus sign. So this two accounts for the contribution from these two triple contact points, and the minus sign comes from the fact that chiral and anti-chiral mode move in the opposite way under modular flow. So in this way, you turn this plus sign into minus sign. And now the next question is, here we have this non-universal constant epsilon. How do you get rid of that? And that is because so this non-universal constant, it enters the line density of this this particle, this mode, while they also enters the velocity of this modes, and the contribution is given by this line density times the velocity, so the epsilon cancels each other, and you end up with a universal result. So this is the mechanism that you can get a universal result from this non-universal things, like K and the QBC expectation value, they are all non-universal, but their commutator has the expectation value of the commutator has a universal result because of this cancellation mechanism. Okay, and now I want to provide some numerical justification. Right now I can only do free fermion lattice model. And it's a pi flux model with some weak disorder. I want to make the situation a bit more generic. You don't have translation symmetry and so on. And so this is a tuning parameter. It has three phases. One is a time reversal symmetric phase, it's trivial. And this middle phase has chain number one, and this guy has chain number two. Chain number zero. And you can see that as we increase the subsystem size, the curve becomes more and more flat and steeper and steeper. So it converges to desired quantized value actually exponentially fast in the subsystem size. Okay. And
I have a question. I'm getting a bit confused. So that you said it vanishes identically when chain number is zero. So it vanishes for less than eta less than zero, but when eta is bigger than two, it's not exactly zero.
Here it's a time reversal symmetric phase, and
Okay. So you're saying for eta bigger than two, although the chain number is zero, but it's not time reversal symmetric or something. Okay. Yes.
Yeah, but you can see the curve becomes more and more steeper. Steeper and steeper. This is what I mean by checking this. This is what I really mean by checking this in free fermion case. So I'm checking. Where is it? Oh, sorry. Yeah, I can deform the shape of ABC. And like in this way, and you can see that the result doesn't change across the entire phase diagram. And here, the size of the block, you can change the size of block, and doesn't have to be much larger than the correlation length. It can be comparable with the correlation length. And no matter how you change it, this entire curve doesn't change. And also you can change the topology, but that will have a very significant effect. There are two types of change you can make. One is to consider annulus as asked by Tyrone before. So you dig a hole inside, and the result is shown by this orange curve. You get just zero, basically. And that is because you have if you can repeat this analysis, actually, and show it's zero. Or another intuitive reason is that you have a left moving and right moving mode on the inner and outer edge, and their contribution cancels each other. Okay. Another type of change that you can make is to consider incomplete disk. Okay. Here, I cut out this sector for region C. So now we have a four-party contact point, not just the triple contact point. And as you can see, that as I increase this angle delta theta, and so this guy starts from a value 1 and jumps to a value like 0.5, and then eventually goes to 0. And you may ask, why is 0.5? And you remember that we argue here there are two triple contact points that makes the same contribution to the formula. As soon as you cut an angle here, you lose the contribution from this triple contact point, but you still have the contribution from the other triple contact point. Okay, that's why it plateaus at 0.5. And
do you mean if the regions are large enough, it's supposed to be exactly 1/2?
Oh, that I'm not sure. I think it still depends on the lattice detail. Right? You cannot get rid of like what happens right at the four-party contact point. There will also always something like messing things up there. As no matter how you increase the subsystem size ABC, you only change the behavior here, but you cannot change behavior here. Oh, sorry.
I see.
So it won't be exactly at half.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Sorry,
it's close to half. That can be understood through the this picture. Yeah, I'm just want to explain that why it's close to half. I don't say it's exactly at half.
Sorry, maybe I missed it. What is theta zero?
Oh, theta zero is this pi 2π/3, this thing. And now you can try to add some lattice points to region A to remove this four-party triple contact point. Right, you can add some dots here. And now you recover just triple contact point. And as you add more and more lattice point here, and the formula recovers and quantizes the value because you only have triple contact point again. And this picture applies. Okay, the point is that changing topology has a significant effect, and that can be understood through the picture I introduced before. And in Fermion systems with just single charged fermion, one can combine results for the chirocentric charge and the quantum Hall conductance to obtain an entanglement version of the Wiedemann-Frenz law. Okay, so this part gives you the Hall conductance, thermal Hall conductance, and this part gives you the electric Hall conductance, and they have the relation given by this. So this is the entanglement version of the familiar Wiedemann-Frenz law. And you can do a numerical calculation on the left-hand side. And the result seems to suggest that it holds even at the critical point. Notice that the result we obtain for each component works only for gapped state, but maybe this formula itself can be applies to like larger parameter regime, for example, at the critical point. But it's unlikely to be true for systems with a Fermi surface. But how to characterize the violation, I don't know yet.
Did you try it on a Fermi surface wave function and see what it looks like?
Oh yeah, so you get non-zero result.
Okay, I see.
But the question is, how do you obtain a form of an analytical formula for that? That's another question.
So again,
we have seen numerical results for free Feynman systems, but actually you can do something better. You can do analytical proof in such system and show that this formula, they are actually correct. The reason that you can do a proof here is that the two-point function determines everything. And for example, even the including entanglement. So the entanglement Hamiltonian takes the fermion bilinear form, and that is dictated by the two-point function restrict to the region X in this way. And so, for example, if we want to look at the commutator of just restricted, the entanglement Hamiltonian, KAB, KBC, and that amounts to understand the commutator between the single particle matrices. And if you do a Taylor expansion, this KAB will give you PAB to some power m. This KBC will give you PBC to some power n. And you take the commutator, and the PABC comes from another two-point function. And you have to understand this quantity. And up to some combinatorial manipulation, this guy is equivalent to the following thing. So let me explain. So P against two-point function in this system is a projector projected onto the single particle space spanned by the states below your Fermi energy. So P is a projector. P squared equals to P. And A and B are the real space projector onto region A and B. And you can, so A and B are commute with each other. But after you project this A and B to the field of states and consider PAP, PBP, they don't commute. But you can quantify their non-commutativity in this way, and it's given by this simple formula. Oh, sorry, there shouldn't be an I here. Okay. And this form might remind you of this Euler beta function, and it is related to that. And one can actually come up with a smooth version of this formula. So A and B doesn't have to be some real space projector, but can be some arbitrary two-dimensional functions, the functions defined on this two-dimensional plane. And it has to have a stable asymptotic value at infinity. That's the only requirement. And you can show something like this. So these functions commute, but after you do a projection, they don't commute. And you can compute the commutator and take a trace that is just dictated by this thing. So in some sense, on the right-hand side, we have the classical calculus, but on the left-hand side, we have the quantum calculus, and they are related, and their relation is controlled by the Chern number, nu. And the m equals to n equals to 1 case is related to the GMP algebra, more precisely the central extension of the GMP algebra. Okay, I'm short in time, so let me just give a summary. So we proposed the entanglement linear response as a framework to understand the relation between topological phenomena and the quantum entanglement. And extracting Hall conductance and chiral central charge are just some applications, specific applications. And one can understand this formula via bulk edge correspondence, for example, namely how the modular flow evolves this edge degrees of freedom, and the velocity and their line density cancel each other, end up giving a universal result, although each component is non-universal. Okay, so it gives suggests some new links between transport and entanglement. And the question is how to generalize this to other symmetries and, for example, higher dimensions. What if you have a three-dimensional topological insulator? Can we do something similar? There, one might have to use consider some nonlinear order. Also, what's the implication of such formula in tensor networks? For example, can one show that PAPS must have vanishing result if you compute it using these formulas? of other things like implication in TQFT. How do you formulate and calculate this formula requires some new thoughts on defining entanglement in quantum field theory. And I'll also mention this third assumption that is questioned a lot during the talk, and how do you develop a better understanding on this assumption. It's an important quantum information question on its own. And with that, I would like to thank you for your attention and take more questions.
All right, thanks, Ruhua. Any question?
Is it possible to give a direct argument for why the whole conduction should be quantized from this formula?
Oh yeah, that is hard. That I don't know. Yeah, it's similar to that. You cannot directly prove gamma is quantized. The topological time entropy is quantized. So the best, I guess, people can do is you first show it's universal, meaning that it doesn't change under smooth deformation of the state. And you work with a fixed point wave function and you get the result. And the result for the fixed point wave functions are quantized. And so you know it's quantized.
Thanks.
Yeah, Tarun.
Yeah, thank you for a very nice talk. Earlier you argued that if the entanglement Hamiltonian is a CFT Hamiltonian up to some proportionality, then you argued that this works. I was wondering, is there some relation of or generalization of that to case where the bulk wave function is related to a CFT correlation function, like a Laughlin state, or many of these things are just correlation functions of CFT, the wave functions. Is there some way to extend that argument to such a thing, or?
I didn't get the question.
Suppose I tell you that the wave function in the bulk is related to some CFT correlation function. Let's say some vertex operator in some CFT. That's how we derive, for example, Laughlin wave function is related to some correlation function of some e to the power I phi operator, right, in the CFT.
That's, you want to consider the strange correlator or the...
No, not strange correlator. Just if I want to derive the Laughlin wave function, I can think of it as related to a correlation function of the boundary CFT of some endpoint correlation function, the end particles.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I see.
So if I assume that there is such a relation between the bulk wave function and correlation function at the edge, could it be that one can, does that relation, if I assume it holds, does it, can one maybe perhaps show that for those class of states, one can argue your the relation between the central charge and the sigma xy and this commutator? Because you were able to at least show that if the boundary Hamiltonian, I mean, if the entanglement Hamiltonian is just that CFT Hamiltonian, then you made very concrete progress showing that this works. I was wondering, that's somewhat related to that those class of wave functions are.
Yeah, I think that is possible. Yeah, that's possible.
Mm-hmm. Because then the Laughlin wave function, then you can show analytically. Laughlin wave function is one class of those wave functions. So
yeah, that is right.
But I don't know, but maybe, yeah.
Yeah, I have a related comment on that. I haven't thought about this problem from the perspective you said, but just look at the wave function itself. So if you just consider, say, an integer quantum Hall wave function, doesn't have to be Laughlin, and we want to compute the entanglement Hamiltonian for this disk region. Okay, and that is simple because this geometry fits the gauge we choose. We choose the circular gauge or symmetric gauge. But if you want to work out the entanglement Hamiltonian for region AB, it will be very awkward. So we have to pick a different gauge. And that new gauge should fit the region A, B, shape of region AB. And similar, we need to pick a different gauge if we want to compute the entanglement Hamiltonian for region BC. And in some sense, this formula is asking whether the two whether they commute, or I don't know how to put it very precisely, but I can imagine that CFT calculation will encounter similar similar things.
Question?
Yeah.
I just want to make sure, when you use the CFT genetically for a fixed bulk topological phase, its boundary CFT is not unique. Does the answer depend on which CFT we choose?
Yeah, I think the answer is yes. Yeah, it can depend on those details. The dependence is this. Here, I assume that this operator flows to a certain operator in the CFT, and some operator in the lattice flows to a certain operator in the CFT. But whether it does flows to that depends on which CFT operator it flows to. Eventually, depends on some UV details, and that's some ambiguity you can have. Does that make sense?
Yeah, but I'm not sure if it answers my question.
Uh-huh.
So suppose my goal is just to calculate the whole conductance or cryocentral charge. Am I correct that as long as I use one of the many CFTs, then I will get the right answer? Or do I have to choose a particular one?
Many CFTs.
Now suppose I have some 2D bulk state. I want to use this argument, then which CFT should I choose?
I think Liu Jing is asking if you have two possible different CFTs on the boundary of the same bulk.
Oh, yeah, I guess they should. For this question, you should get the same answer. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Because whole conductance and the cryocentral charge are determined by the bulk.
Yeah.
But will some other entanglement linear response quantities depend on the choice? So if I just look at this slide, you initially have KL plus KR, and I think you have some argument at some point, the KR becomes minus KR.
Yeah.
That seems to only apply to the second moment of Q, right?
Oh, but the thing is that notice alpha only depends on mu squared. So only second moment is relevant for all these calculations.
Yeah, I know. But if I just want to study entanglement response in general, not necessarily the whole conductance, and the use.
Oh, yeah, then.
Okay. Thanks.
Yeah, so, thanks for the question.
So I have a maybe related question. So if you say deform the CFT by adding some non-local terms, say given that modular Hamiltonian can be non-local, do you expect your result to be robust against such deformation?
Are you considering edge CFT of 2D bulk or just genuine?
If you change the modular Hamiltonian from CFT Hamiltonian to something else.
Uh-huh. Oh, yeah. So the answer, yeah, so that's this property, like this universal.
But can we check that directly from the
I see. Yeah, that's a good point. So the tricky thing is not yeah a simple deformation of so we always allow to deform the modular Hamiltonian, but that may not correspond to a local deformation of the state. So what we want is we first deform the state locally and ask what the entanglement Hamiltonian is deformed. And if we play with those, I can call it legitimate deformation of a modular entanglement Hamiltonian, then we have to first restrict ourselves to those deformation and then ask this question. But to me, even the first thing is, I have to think about it, but I think it's an interesting question. Yeah, I haven't thought about it.
Yeah, okay. So, for example, if you restrict your Hamiltonian to be in the same symmetry, you want charge conservation and same center charges, but you're saying within that class, there can be still some further restriction that can arise from short range entanglements or
Exactly. Yeah.
I see.
Yeah, I have to be honest on this point that I have very little knowledge on the structure of entanglement Hamiltonian, and as a Hamiltonian, it doesn't have to be local. For example, it can have a parallel tail. That seems to be possible.
It might be interesting to study, understand under what kind of deformation is this is your result stable.
Mm. Okay. Yeah, that's an interesting question. Mm-hmm.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah, thanks. I saw Tarong.
Do you have a question?
Yeah, I have one more question. Maybe this is an obvious question, but I'm sure you have thought about this and maybe it's just too hard, but if I consider a Fermi surface case, so there's this famous work by Haldane where he showed that the non-quantized part of the Hall conductivity, if you, let's say, partially fill a churn band, that's property of the Fermi surface and so on, and it's related to the very phase vector by particle around the Fermi surface. If I just calculate this quantity, which you are for a partially filled churn band, do you get that non-quantized part? Is it related to it, or is it just some completely else, you think? Because here you're considering fully. Sorry?
Yeah, this is something that I really want to check, but I don't know how to start.
But you can, for the free fermion, at least you know what the non-quantized part of the Hall conductance is. You can calculate that using just simple free fermion calculation. There's a
expression, right?
And then you can compare it with your what comes out of this interesting view. There are two different numbers. You can check whether there's some maybe they're proportional to each other with something or.
Oh, you mean numerically or?
Numerically for free fermion. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I should try that. Yeah.
Yeah, that's a good. It's still it is Hall conductivity. It's not quantized, but it is, it's there and it has similar symmetry properties. I mean, I would think the reflection and so on, it should change. So, and it has same units as your formula. So it has many of those simple checks, but I don't know what. Since your thing anyway is not obviously quantized, right? So that may be a good thing.
I don't think it's quantized, and it should depend on the shape of ABC.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, because because you don't have this property anymore, right? For Fermi. Yeah.
That's true. Yeah.
Maybe a slightly simpler version of that for the integer quantum Hall plateau transition. I mean, you can put it on the lattice, make a Dirac fermion. If you plug it in here, do you get something like 1/2?
Yeah, very close to 1/2. Yeah, indeed. Ah. Yeah.
Okay.
And that is irrespective of the shape. You earlier saying there may be shape dependence, that is one half is does not depend on the shape.
Oh, that I forgot. I forgot. It's like this point. Yeah, and you can see because I deform the shape, and this curve doesn't change much, and so it has some strong evidence, but I don't know whether it's true exactly. I have to think more carefully on that. But, I think these are two very interesting questions, like Dirac fermions or with the Fermi surface.
Pretty cool, thanks.
All right, if there's no other question, I assume no, okay. Let's just thank Rihua again.
Yeah, thanks everyone. Thanks for the questions.